do brief introductions of your own selves to the audience? That's probably the easiest thing. So you've got 1 minute max, but you know, introduce yourself and say anything you want about
Good evening. My name is Richard Wright. I'm the Executive Director of Sheffield Chamber of Commerce, so I represent the business sector. My background is very much in the manufacturing sector. Lots of people that are as old as me will remember Firth Brown. If you were younger, it was called Sheffield Forge Masters. Obviously, massive energy users. Sorry?
Okay, I'll move the mic.
That's a recorder.
Sorry.
Can we get a mic too? Or maybe just stand up.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm an old man, you know, my voice goes. Thank you. Can you hear me now? Yeah. So, for people that didn't hear, my name's Richard Wright. I'm the Executive Director of Sheffield Chamber, representative of the business sector. Obviously, big energy users, everybody's aware of us, faced with some big issues, just the same as everybody else, and trying very hard to work our way through that. We understand the fact that we have to reduce our carbon emissions. We have to do that in a way that's compatible with a lot of other needs in the industry, or in the world actually, around creating wealth, creating jobs, all of those things. And sometimes they seem a little bit in competition with each other.
Right, thank you. My name's Martin Mayer. I'm president of the Sheffield Trades Council, which is our local TUC representing all the trade unions in the city. As a day job, I'm a bus driver. I'm Unite, the union branch secretary at Sheffield South Yorkshire Buses. Green job, bus driver. So I'm quite interested in public transport. Public transport, of course, has contracted enormously because of privatisation and deregulation, and I want to see a difference to that. I'm also on the Unite the Union Executive Council. I represent all the bus drivers in the country on the Executive Council. And we're very much involved in the politics of today and tomorrow. And we look to try and influence the Labour Party for a positive programme post-austerity in the future. And part of that is about infrastructure investment. And we're particularly keen on investing in sustainable growth, green growth, green jobs. And I'm particularly interested in developing a public sector programme of investment in low carbon emission housing, council housing in particular, in renewable energy, in insulation, and of course my own industry, the expansion of public transport.
I'm Jack, and I'm not going to talk anymore. You had enough of me in the group.
I have to skip over you two.
Okay, I'm Jeremy White. I'm Director of Public Health for Sheffield. I'm here primarily because I believe that climate change is the definitive public health challenge for this century. And if you give me the chance later on, I'll tell you why.
Pick your own question.
Good evening. I'm Andy Nolan. I'm from the City Council. And over the last few years, I've led some of the policy and strategy work around the carbon and climate change agenda for the council. I'm now working largely with the university on an exciting programme around sustainable cities, looking at exactly the points that have been made at the end by Andy on how cities can actually take the lead on some of the carbon agenda and the issues around social justice and citizen engagement.
Now, over to you. Do you want to stand up, probably? Because if they didn't have any question or statement.
I'm very impressed by Jack's talk. He got all the cabinet on board. And I have heard from Andy Nolan before that he's one of the officers that's on board, but I'm not convinced that all the officers of the council believe that climate change is the most important thing. And as a second part of that question, I wonder, how are you going to stand up to the car lobby? I know the previous Liberal administration always seemed to be talking about how can we
Do you want to take a couple, or do you want to just pick that one?
Okay, that's a good idea.
James Thomas, 20th year, and I'm very interested in the rise of some of the climate deniers and some of the things that suddenly seem to be emerging recently in sort of political discourse, which is, I think, quite worrying for us. Certainly when we've listened to these fantastic presentations tonight, where we know where the science seems to be, I think, really fairly self-evident. I'd be very interested in the panel's views on what we could do collectively to make sure that we embed the sort of the right of science in this whole debate.
So we'll take four and then we can probably go
on. Thank you, David. Sharing those solar acts of the past 20 years here in Sheffield. This came to me so late, but my question is, in the time I've been here, how do we get out of, you may have already spoken, but how do we get out of the hands of the energy suppliers? The way in which they're interpreting and applying their resources for climate change. And what it is money. Their focus is making money from it. So how do we get out of their hands? Because from my point of view, this is the biggest greenwashed government I've ever experienced. And how do we change their colours to what it truly is?
Ken Curran, chair of the corporate party in Sheffield. I want to thank Jack for his initiative, incidentally, highlighting the necessity for reducing the climate change in the city. Up to the present time, none of the political leaders, really, in my view, have taken this question seriously enough. And that applies both locally and nationally. And that is a major impediment, in effect, towards developing a nationwide campaign about the difficulties that we face in the future. Locally, and this evening, you've spoken about the effect of our lifestyle upon the climate. But in addition to that, and it needs coupling together, is the fact that the petrol engines, the combustion engines, are emitting metals, dangerous metals, into the atmosphere at a very low level. And therefore, it's affecting the health of our children. And in this city, 500 lives are lost per year. That's the average of the effect of the vehicles in the city. And that's got to be done. And the politicians, the Liberal Democrats, have been hypocritical about this all the time. Because the last time the council attempted to do something about parking in the city in order to reduce the amount of cars coming in, they screamed that that's anti-business. And we need a massive campaign, quite frankly, a door-to-door campaign across the city in order to convince the people that we must change the way in which we live. Thank you.
Okay, there's four things to
have
a go at. Sorry, you can't hear the questions at the back, can you? So if you want to kind of say a little bit of feedback, feedback the question for, as well as doing the answer. Hold on, we're just doing answering these questions first.
Okay, so the first two questions. One was about, probably directed about the City Council in particular. And I think what was asked was some of the, it's great. I think what was being said was it's great that the Cabinet and the administration understand what we're doing and how important this is, but actually do all our officers understand it? And I think the honest answer is that probably no, I don't think they do, but actually they aren't dissimilar to the population in that sense. Actually, the biggest problem we've got isn't the fact that some officers might understand it. The biggest problem we've got is that so few of our population as a whole understand it, actually. And honestly, the stories that I hear when I knock on doors, in whether it's in my ward or in other parts of the city, and I talk about global warming or global burning, as I always try and call it, and climate change and everything else, you know, and people say, oh, it's great, I'll get a tan. You know, I mean, the level of public understanding that there is a major issue. And that doesn't stop just because people are senior officers. So my job, the Cabinet's job, and actually, very challengingly, all of your job, I think, as well, is to make sure that we all raise the level of public understanding and public urgency about the issue. And that applies to some of our officers as much as it applies to anyone else. I think there was another question about the car lobby. I'm so pleased I got those two first. I think there's a few things that we're doing in particular. One is around encouraging people to shift the mode of transport that they use. So there's some good progress that's just about starting, about encouraging bus use, about the Optio gateway that we're going to have in the city, which is going to make some real differences. So within 6 months there will be an Oyster card type use on that particular route, which will be really useful. Other things we're doing, I'm in charge of the Streets Ahead project, so things around installing cycle lanes in the vast majority of the city's substantial roads, which will be really positive as well, and also things to try and encourage walking through a better lit city and that sort of stuff. So there's some sort of project things that we're doing to try and encourage people. A much bigger issue is the low emission zone study that we're conducting at the moment, and we know what some of the consequences of that low emission zone study might well be in terms of where our emissions come from. And I think that probably leads me to the very final point about the car lobbies, that again, actually, we need your help in this. You know, you can't be surprised, nobody should be surprised that politicians want to win elections. You know, don't stand for election if you don't want to win, really. So when we do something that's positive about, that people might view as positive about city centre car parking, or that people think is positive in terms of charges or changes to the emissions that taxis might have, or something like that, a policy on cars, if we do something that's bad, I expect people to write to the start and talk to people and tell me off, okay? But actually, I also expect the opposite as well. When we do something that's good, when we do something that is brave and ambitious and bold, I also need your help, actually, to say, well done, you know what, this council's got vision and they've got determination and they're taking big and bold action and we applaud it. Otherwise, we'll be inundated with anti-car and everything else and we won't win. So I need your help as well, I think, okay? And then I'll pass the others on to other people, I think.
Yes,
sorry, can we, you want to, so the thing about climate denial as well, so Jane's question I think was about there's a growing mood about climate change denial. So just to say, I got my letter this morning from Eric Pickles about wind turbines. I wish he would stop writing to me, actually, because he does it all the time. Does someone else want to talk about the growing tempo of climate denial?
I think the climate science community, of which I'm on the edge, I suppose, is more of a policy person. Maybe you're more in the middle. But we've thought about it a lot with the scandals at UEA and how to fight back, I suppose. And I'd make two points. One is a criticism of the BBC, actually, and other mainstream media, who tend to present it as having one climate scientist and one climate sceptic. When it's not those odds at all, it's 999 climate scientists who think it's pretty clear, and one climate sceptic who's I don't know if we're allowed to use the word swivel eye. That's not right. And the incentives for the climate science community to debunk climate science are huge. You know, there would be a Nobel Prize only for an individual if you could disprove climate science. They're a contrarian lot, often scientists, and they would love to come up with an alternative science which was more plausible. And I think that's a point we can make too. One other thing I would say is that I think, however, our science communication, the way we talk about climate science, could evolve in the wake of the UEA scandal and some of the controversies and the prominence of the denials. Because, you know, I think that there is a basic fact of climate change, which is if you put carbon in the atmosphere, it will attract heat and the world will get warmer. That is a fact. Thereafter, there's a strong scientific consensus about many of the climate impacts, but there are also risks and uncertainties. And I think we are on safer ground if we talk about climate impacts, especially at a local level, as climate risks. You know, there is a very, very substantial risk that ecosystems, public health and so on will be severely disrupted, or even beyond the point of being able to adapt. It's not a fact, though. We can't quite say that it's a risk. And if we talk about it as a risk and are honest about that, I think we are more able to defend the climate science and more able to make plausible points. I sense that there's a bit of a move towards that in the academic community, but it may be just in the centre that I direct.
Well, let's take up the issue about the car lobby to start with. I think it's in everybody's interest that we have an efficient, low-carbon transport system in our cities, and public transport is the key to that. The fact is the Labour Party has a very good policy on this, which the unions have been very careful to be involved in and help to create. And what we would do under the next government would be to introduce quality contracts. This would at least bring the regulation back into the chaotic mess of competition which we have at the moment. In an ideal world, I would love to see the buses brought back into municipal ownership. If you go to European cities where they've retained municipal ownership, you'll see that fares can be kept much lower. An investment in vehicles is very, very good, and you get very good integrated systems which encourages more people to use it. And it comes down to politics. And it is about the politics of whether we want government intervention at national and local level, because private enterprise cannot provide all the solutions. I've been campaigning with my union and European transport unions in Europe, and we're absolutely devastated by the European Commission's proposals for sustainable transport, which seems to say that if you open up the market more than it is at the moment, it'll regulate itself and you'll have the solutions you're all looking for. And it's a neoliberal mantra, which is nonsense. So coming back to some of the wider questions about how do we counter the myth that there is no climate change problem, or get the issues across to people, I think it's about campaigning. And I think it's about campaigning organisations like Sheffield Trainings Against Climate Change, and the organisations that are trying to link up with wider society to make events like this happen and educate people. Because unfortunately, through the mainstream media, we're not getting this very much, are we? So I hope that all of you don't just come here today to listen to a few of us speaking, but you take these messages back out and communicate with other people too. I mean, David, I know we've been involved in your Solar Active charity, which has been trying to promote the benefits of plugging into the sun and using that as an educational tool, so that youngsters in our education establishments can also see in a practical way how using solar energy and renewable energy is actually beneficial for people. I mean, the final point about air quality, it's quite shocking that the air quality levels, particularly around the motorway viaduct, have been some of the highest in Britain. And it reflects an absolute failure by all of us in society to deal with transport, which is just one of the major contributors towards global emissions. But it's one that I'm very much involved in, my union's very much involved in, the ITF, the International Transport Workers Federation, is also very much involved in. And we have got a lot of ideas. It's getting the politicians to listen to us. And I don't mean you, Jack, because I know that you're doing a great job here in the City Council, but I mean national and international policymakers to accept that this really is an issue that matters. And frankly, I think, has got a lot of public support if they're brave enough to do it.
Thank you. Yeah, it's four interesting questions, actually. It brought up four great points about if you think about getting rid of cars and are the officers convinced? No, they aren't. Not all of them, they are, but actually lots and lots are getting more convinced, and I see that every day. And that's why we're here tonight, and that's why things like the LED lighting with the new road system is, it's a massive energy saver for this city that the council didn't have to go for, so I'll defend the council there. The thing about why on earth don't we do it when it's so self-evident is a good one, and I think I'll try and tackle that. And the other one is how you get the money aspect, the energy suppliers and the money aspect. And then the other one was the how on earth do we get people doing it? Yes, how do we get things? And I think the way I try and answer is to, in business we talk about three numbers. First number is called cost. And fundamentally that's how much does it cost you to make a kilowatt hour of electricity in this instance. And the fact is, like it or not, it probably costs you more for something from wind energy than it does from fossil fuel. The next number is price, and that's usually what the energy suppliers sell us the energy at. And that reflects the fact that some of it is from renewables, some of it is from fossil, and they also make money. Let's not beat around the bush. They make money, they're a business. And you can have a debate about whether they make too much, but in one corner you might be, yeah, I agree, but in one corner you'll be saying, well, hang on, the big pension funds are big investors in energy, and they've got to make money for the pensions, and then the other side they're making too much money out. Well, I'm not interested in that, but that's how it is. I think the other one, which is a really interesting one, which actually comes to is a thing called value. And value is an interesting one, because in the circumstances of how we're speaking tonight, the real question here is, how much do we value the planet? To pay a higher price for our electricity, because we're actually going to produce a bigger proportion of it in a renewable way. And that's actually the choice of the population, really. It bypasses everything. And actually, that's a debate that we have not won with the vast majority of the population, whether we like it or not. Otherwise, there'd be more people here tonight. And we have not won that one. And if I was actually saying there is something we need to do collectively, it doesn't matter whether you're a business person, whether you're a domestic person, in the definitions earlier, we have to win that debate. And once we win that debate, then things will move on.
Should I take some more questions?
We need the mic, I think, though.
Lots of questions. Do you want to take four panels?
My question is, it's complicated, but it's got several parts to it. Imagine a date like 2050, and you're looking back, and it looks as if we made great strides in dealing with decarbonization and everything. How did we do it? Did we do it without rationing individual energy? Is it possible to do it without saying, this is the amount of fuel, electricity and so on that you can have and you can't exceed it? You can't exceed it by three times just because you've got money to pay for it. Because as wealth gets more inequitable, rich people are still going to be able to spend a lot and buy a lot of energy, even if the energy costs really go up. So there's a social justice issue there. Can it be done without rationing? Looking back, did we do it without actually outlawing the private car? Did we do it without outlawing non-necessary luxury goods, especially imported ones? Did we do it without saying you can't any longer, you're not allowed to fly into Prague to get pissed for your hen now. You're not allowed to do it. When are we going to say you can't do that sort of thing? When are we going to say you can't fly to the other end of Europe for a football match? Is it possible to do it without measures like that? Looking back, honestly, put yourself in 2050, look back. We've done it. Did we do it without such very unwelcome measures? Did we get a local food production economy going without legislating for it? Did we do it without making sure that the growing areas are secured really seriously against theft, because we've got a future of resource competition, not only internationally, but we're going to have it person to person. You're going to be growing, your leeks are going to be just about ready, you're going to go to your allotment, somebody's taken a lot. That's going to happen. Or is it going to happen? Look back, what did we do it without doing that? Did we do it without making sure that all compostable wastes our compost didn't return to the soil. We can't, can we make sure things like that happen without legislation? Now, I know that one of the things levelled against greenies by, you know, for decades now, is you're just green fascists, you want to tell us what to do. But look back, did we do these things without really unpleasant measures that a lot of people will resist? That's a big question.
Solar hot water fraction on people's roofs rather than just electric, so that we can have some housing stock transition away from gas usage over the next couple of cycles, decade. I could ask another part of that question, but I'll just leave it at that.
There's a guy next to you, just for efficiency of your walking, Chris.
Well, I just want to ask, we talk about carbon capture and stuff. I'm just wondering, have you thought about actually using natural, hopefully it's good for building, but all this wood, how many trees would we need to plant to actually begin to use carbon in this atmosphere?
Well,
it's
come to the front, Chris, there's a couple of women on the front. So is it?
Hello, I'm Matthew again. I'm a student at the University of York. I recently did a dissertation project about community-owned energy projects, so I'm wondering, would the City Council support those?
Are you asking about the question?
I'd like to ask a question about land use changes in the city region. I noticed there are two presenters didn't bring that in. And I think we do know about land use and how the soils can in fact become a carbon sink when currently under industrial agriculture they're a source. And just thinking around our region where we've got rough grazing, and just thinking, are there thoughts about woodland that could be, you know, biomass sources, and how we can bring in more organic agriculture, which is good for health as well as good for the soils.
I just want to just say something for Mother Earth, really, and for the female aspect. I do think we concentrate on politics a lot, we concentrate on economics a lot, and we forget that we need to actually reconnect with Mother Nature in order to solve our problems. I think that's basically, to me, that's how I see it. We need to reconnect with nature. And I'll echo what you said about using our connection with nature to tackle this problem. And I just was a little bit concerned about one sentence that I've forgotten your name from Manchester. It sounded like you were saying, We've left agriculture out because agriculture is absolutely essential. But to me, the way that we are conducting our agriculture is completely and utterly fossil fuel dependent, and it needs to completely change. And we do have ways of doing that, which is permaculture. And I think we need to, I would like to see Sheffield looking into using the land and using the nature, and using that connection with nature that people can develop from growing their own food and using permaculture systems.
Thank you very much.
I just want to pick up on that last point. One of the more worrying statistics that I've read about our present dependence on fossil fuels is that for every calorie of food that we produce globally, we consume, and I've heard different figures, I've heard a figure of 8 calories, 11 calories, and 13 calories of fossil fuel energy to produce 1 calorie of food energy. And that's a really rather frightening statistic when one considers the growth in human populations, the increased tendency of large numbers of the world's population to shift from vegetarian to meat-based diets, and the implications of all of that. So it just seems to be another example of the way that our overall approach to the consumption of fossil fuels is so locked into the way that we live and into our economies. The scale of the challenge is extraordinary. And I honestly don't know how we reverse that, because frankly I don't believe that we can feed the people of Sheffield, let alone the people of England or the world, on organic farming. It just doesn't quite stack up as far as I can tell, much as I would like it to. The other observation I wanted to make really relates to some of the earlier questions about how we engage people with this problem more generally. I think that we have to not be afraid to continually point out the scale of the challenge that faces us. I think there's a tendency for those of us who do believe that this is the biggest challenge that we face to shy away from sticking our necks out and being objectionable and making a fuss about it and so on. And I just think we've got to get over that and make the point that a lot of the problems that we are already seeing are linked to climate change. So people complain about the increase in food prices. One of the major drivers of the increase in food prices globally is climate change in the big food producing areas of the world. And we need to point out those links as and when they come up in conversation and in debates about policy and so on and so forth. We've had extraordinary political turmoil across the Middle East in the last three years since the Arab Spring. There is very clear evidence that the political turmoil in the Middle East, which has caused countless hundreds of thousands of deaths, overthrows of governments, has been related to increase in food prices, increase of staple foods in those countries, which in turn have been related to climate change itself. So we need to point out these links repeatedly and keep chipping away and making the case that actually an awful lot of the very current problems that people are facing now are related to climate change. If we just talk about 4-degree future or 6-degree future, and how the world's going to fly in 2050, we're not going to engage people in this debate. We've got to engage people in the issues that they're facing now.
Just to qualify the way we've treated emissions from food in those accounting exercises, what we did there was to set an average emissions intensity for the food system for the given number of people at each point in time, and to say that by 2050 we would have halved the present emissions intensity, and so that would allow for some increases for those less productive and less consuming areas, but substantial decreases for other parts of the world. So that's a future energy, a future food system that is twice as effective in terms of emissions per person by 2050. Just to pick up on a couple of questions earlier that were related to the importance of denial in present political discourses and the organisation of energy infrastructure and energy supply. I've been working recently around shale gas, and it concerns me that something that is related to shale gas is denialism, and that they're both somewhat opportunistic, that I don't think that the people who are prominent in those debates are being entirely honest even with themselves. So the presence of a large potential volume of gas underground doesn't tell you about how much it costs to get up or the impact of that on UK energy bills, household energy bills. And it seems from the academic research groups down in London at UCL, I know I've been looking at this, it seems like to echo, as Andy said earlier, that the presence of the gas, even if it comes up at prices that are comparable to now, which is of no guarantee, it's a trivial activity, fracking, certainly not in one that would be highly regulated in the UK, so it would not have a substantial impact. And Quadrilla admitted as much. The Quadrilla's PR firm, there's a story in The Independent today, and there's a link to it from my Twitter feed, saying as much. So there's something disingenuous in that rhetoric, in that the possibility of gas is being of indigenous gas is being dangled as a carrot, as a way of trying to remove a consensus towards large-scale investment in renewables and in low-carbon supply options. And so, and I think that denialism is similar, and I think that that is an echo of the power of the fossil fuel lobby in contemporary politics. I think also we need to be not entirely naive around the renewables industry, that there are, and certainly the low-carbon industry, the government is in tight negotiations with both the companies that would build offshore wind turbines and the companies that would build potentially nuclear power stations. And the prices that we would pay are a matter of some kind of hot discussion and debate. And there's a large tension there, but it does seem that we will need to some degree, even with some decentralisation of energy, without a very radical reduction in our demand for energy, we are going to need some large-scale energy infrastructure, and at present that is being delivered in a market framework, and so that is colouring all kinds of energy investment and debate.
Do you have more questions?
Yeah, I just want to pick up one question, if maybe two. Just one in particular about the issue about community energy projects, to say that we've got a fantastic social enterprise in Sheffield called Sheffield Renewables. We want to make sure we do absolutely everything we possibly can to support that. Although actually, if it's going to be a community energy project, it's got to be a community energy project, you know, so one that is community owned but council backed. You know, I think we've got to make sure we don't lose some of the fantastic, innovative and sort of more interesting aspects of community owned projects by us as a council with a fairly big, bulky fist and quite a lot of money going in and changing something. So I'm anxious we don't do that, but I really want to make sure we support that. I mean, I suppose the only other two things to say in terms of energy that I think are important. One is to make it absolutely clear for anyone who doesn't know that today the Labour Party announced that the decarbonisation target that was meant to be in the energy bill that we lost the amendment on will be a manifesto commitment in the next manifesto, which is absolutely fantastic. And we are, you know, it's a rock solid cast iron guarantee that we will, if we win the next election, we will put that on. So, yeah. And the second part, well,
that's
very
expensive.
All right, well, if you don't want us to put it in, we won't put it in, you know. I mean, and then the second part of it really is, I think it's really important to say it's about fracking, that we want to work, and we're going to work with Sheffield Climate Alliance to co-produce a policy, make sure we have a clear policy in Sheffield about fracking. So a commitment and actually some real action as well, which seems to me how we'll get some decent movement forward on some of these things.
I'll be very quick, there are a couple of interesting questions in the middle of that round, but I'm also conscious that nobody's answered your question.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm not sure I can. The question at the back was really interesting about, you know, position of cities and government policy in particular. So putting aside any sort of real party politics, irrespective of who's in power, the one thing we haven't had for far too long is stability of policy. And I think what we've tried to do as Sheffield and with our other provincial larger cities in England in particular, is to get a closer working relationship with government, because bluntly, policymakers in London and Westminster don't even know what Sheffield looks like. And so we've had to, you know, we're working very, very hard at helping them to understand how policy translates on the ground. So, you know, I think stability and actually
an acceptance and understanding of how it works in cities which aren't London. The next two questions came through quite timely. It's an opportunity to plug it. Your question about how many trees would we need to plant? Well, I would encourage you next Thursday to come to the showroom at 3 o'clock. We're running a big energy challenge, the British Energy Challenge, which Jack has been involved in. We've got Mark Lyons, who many of you will have read books by and seen speak, and the Chief Scientific Officer from DEC. And they are going to be running their carbon calculator, so they will actually tell you, you know, if you don't make some hard decisions about energy, there are going to be some pretty dire consequences. And finally, just very finally, the question about community energy, we think that's really important, and I echo Jack's points on that. Paul Blomfield's running an event on the 28th of this month at St Mary's at Bramall Lane, particularly on that issue of Green Alliance. So I would urge anybody who's interested in that kind of area to come to that event as well.
I'll just be really quick. I was really impressed when the woman who's chair of the National Trust came out in the media last week and said about the reforms to the planning system that we're in danger of losing our national soul through planning reforms. And I completely agree with her. It's not just about economics and economic growth. It's absolutely about soul and values like that. And I suppose I'd relate that back to the first question about how draconian we can or should be in enabling the transition or making it happen. I'd hate to see democracy thrown away in the process of pursuing a low-carbon economy. I think we have to find ways of taking people with us, not just telling them what's going to happen.
My question was, can we do it without serious...
I think we have to.
I'll just kind of make the comment that we did ration in the war. When and people say that you might be a war economy, so it's not that you'd be undermining democracy. Right.
What I want to know is what objections would anybody have to the idea of making all public transport free at the point of use, like we nearly used to do here in South Yorkshire. And I think if we can do that, and I think we can afford it, look at the figures that were on those slides up there, £800 million for this and that, we could easily afford to do that. And that would help send out shockwaves into the public at large that this is serious. And people have been asking that question, how do we get this message across? I'll tell you how we get it across. Let's start by making all public transport free, like we damn nearly used to do, until Margaret Thatcher got her hands on it.
And there's two parts to my question. First part is about, you know, when are we going to have this energy service company that Birmingham's got in Sheffield? And related to that, couple of weeks ago we had a workshop about air quality. And one of the people were saying at that workshop, well, look at how they run the cities, and similar to what Martin said, look how they run the cities in continental Europe, and how they manage to be able to have good transport systems and do all these things as a city. And this is where the Labour Party has failed over the years, is the fact that, which was said at that same meeting, is that the way the government is, regional government set up in all the European countries is a lot different to ours. Ours is the most centralised government in Western Europe, and that is one of the reasons why if Sheffield wants to do things like this energy service company, it's a terribly hard job because the fact of the way the politics is done and where the money follows it. And if we don't change that particular system, then it's always going to be hard, because as you started off saying to Andy, they don't know what's happening north of Watford.
This is
initially, I'd like the councillor to justify his statement that the Streets Ahead programme is actually improving our cycle infrastructure, because we were told at our local community assembly by both Amy and the councillors that it cannot have any changes whatsoever into what cycle paths, and that it's exactly got to replace like for like. And if that is the case, I'd like some of the other panellists to say whether there is still an economic case for changing some of those roads, given they've already been newly replaced, maybe in terms of like the economics of the health impacts or the sort of climate change impacts.
I want to agree with Jeremy's view that climate change is the biggest public health challenge this century, but also to think about that, really, to get the plan to think about how that could be a public health opportunity in actually tackling climate change. And I want to link that to something that Richard said when he first introduced himself, that he felt that tackling climate change could be in contradiction with jobs. And I want to just check, because I think from the report, if I've understood Andrew's report correctly, you know, the carbon impacts are not always in the same place as creating the most jobs. So sometimes you create lots of jobs in one area, but it doesn't save all much carbon. Sometimes you save lots of carbon and it doesn't create any jobs. And it seems to me that the benefit of the doing everything, you can get all the cost neutral policies, all the cost neutral measures, is that you tie all those things together and you get a whole package that brings in creating as many jobs as you can and saving as much carbon as you can. And I mean, my particular belief, it won't be a surprise to anyone, would be about insulating homes, and also that brings in the public health aspect of actually not only keeping people warmer and that reduces health problems, but just actually causing less mental anxiety about bills, which is a huge, absolutely massive problem in our city at the moment. So, to summarise what the question is, you know, how can we actually, as a city, maximise those jobs, and, you know, stop Richard worrying about it, really, that he thinks it might be in contradiction, because I think the amount of jobs we could create in this city could be fantastic, and that in itself would have big public health benefits. You know, people are happier and healthier when they're actually working on something productive. So I'd like the panel's ideas really about this.
You go first. I'll pay
them. Free transport, what a great idea, Ian. I actually don't think we need to go as far as that, because free transport is a massive, massive public subsidy. And if it's currently run as it is, where you're really paying private companies to provide that free transport, you're spending an awful lot of money. I actually think that the sort of policy we had before of very, very low fares, so you don't get abuse of the system on the one hand, but you do get it very attractive, is what you really need to do. I think that, you know, what it really raises the question of it is, are we going to leave some of these issues, whether it's transport or food production or renewable energy or all the other issues which need to create a greener environment, are we going to leave them to deregulated private enterprise to provide? And I think the answer must be no. I think it must be regulation. I think there must be controls. And I think there must be fiscal and other measures to encourage companies to do one thing rather than the other. So if I can relate that slightly back to the big question from the gentleman in the middle row there, I'd hate to think that we'd got to 2050 and achieved what we'd wanted to do by restricting civil liberties, and that we'd been forced to give up really, really important things in our lives. I hope that wouldn't be necessary, and indeed, if that is the message, then we will never win over people to a progressive and quality life for the future, which I think the red-green, you know, political alliance is all about. I mean, contrast it to where we are today. Democratic rights and civil liberties are actually disappearing in front of our eyes in many parts of Europe, and I would perhaps suggest even here. I mean, for Greece to close down its public sector media yesterday was just a sign of what can happen under the current neoliberal regime. We must be offering something
surely much, much better than that. And let's be positive here. I mean, Jenny's point really is that the kind of programme we're looking at, yes, by a healthy, renewed and democratically accountable public sector, is the creation of green jobs. It's the creation of better prosperity. It's a more sustainable life, but also a better life for everybody. And I think we have to approach it in that way. And by the way, Richard, I must insist, we're not being anti-capitalist here. I don't want anyone to get the wrong idea. I think there's a much, much bigger role for local authorities, for government, for the public sector generally. But we need to work properly with the private sector, who are the main providers of the economy. But we need to bring in some acceptable regulation to stop some of the bad practices of globalisation. Because, I mean, we've got far too many industries that are behaving badly in terms of driving costs down for workers to such an extent that we see the disasters we saw in Bangladesh recently, for instance, because that's cheaper to produce goods for the British market by, you know, destroying people's livelihoods at the other side of the world. But that is all globalisation, and it's all excessive transport costs in transferring goods right across the world. And it's not necessary, and it should be discouraged. And we need to find not just national but international ways of discouraging capitalism to work in that way.
As I go home in disappointment, because nobody discussed, you've had the question that the audience is holding. I just want to say one thing that's important. I wasn't advocating something draconian and punitive for the sake of it. I was talking about, did we do this without restricting people's power to pollute, which is a reasonable social law? I'm not a fascist. Two people talked about what I said as being a civil
liberty.
To be fair, that's not quite the way you put it. You did actually ask whether it could be achieved without us as people suffering a worse kind of living standard. I thought that's what
you meant.
It was great,
and
it was
important.
These things are complicated. Yeah. I think Jerry wants to answer the...
Yes, as well, I think I was asked a fairly direct question in that regard, so thank you, Jenny, for that. I think that the relationship between health and public health and the extent of carbonification of the economy is quite a complicated one. There are advantages, without any doubt at all, there are a number of measures that would be both good for health and lead to reduction of carbon emissions and therefore help to mitigate climate change. So, you know, the more active transport we are engaged in, that's better, especially if it displaces car transport. If it's just active transport by itself, it's a good thing, but it's an even better thing if it displaces car transport. If we insulate houses, of course, that's great, and that's good for health, good for the carbon economy, and so on and so forth. But then you can quite quickly get into rather more complicated areas because, like it or not, our economy is carbon based and employment is good for health. And we need to be careful not to, in the enthusiastic pursuit of public health measures and carbon reduction measures, do things that actually have adverse consequences through reducing levels of employment and so increasing the odds of that. So I just think we need to be careful about that. But you're absolutely right. There are lots of things we can do that are better for health and better for the climate, and we should be doing this. I just want to pick up. There are a number of questions that haven't been answered. One question I would like to answer, or at least address, is the issue about free public transport. And I'll just make a couple of observations about this. The first is that actually we need to travel less. And we need to travel, particularly travel less, if the travel involves burning fossil fuels. And I have a real worry that free public transport
will encourage people to travel more. And so before we enthusiastically endorse free public transport, we've got to think about, actually, are we just encouraging people to travel more when we've really got to learn to travel less? The second point is that, of course, free public transport is maybe free at the point you get on the bus, but it's got to be paid for somehow.
Of course.
And if it's going to be paid for somehow, then presumably the implication is it will be paid for out of public funds, and you then have to think about what the possible alternative uses of those public funds are, and would they not be better used, both in from my perspective, purely because it's my business in health terms, or indeed in climate change terms, would those public funds maybe not be better spent somewhere else? So I think it's a very...
It's an
easy thing to argue for, but before one can adopt it, as with so many of these steps that sound superficially to be very attractive, there are a number of implications of them that you need to think through very carefully before you're gone.
Okay. It's coming up to 9 o'clock, and what I'd like is some commitment to action from, well, possibly.
From everybody.
Because Jack said this is a first step. So we want to establish how we do the second step,
really.
Because actually, you know, not all the questions have been answered, but I don't know that that matters. They have been aired, and they are all interesting points. So people are starting to leave, and I want to tell you about something that's sitting on your seat, which looks like this. Yeah.
Use the microphone. Thanks.
Right. Can you hear me now? So on your seats is a little slip from the Sheffield Climate Alliance. There's another announcement that somebody wants to make as well, but let me just tell you about this first. We need to know if you'd like to stay in touch with us, and we need to know if you are interested in any of those activities. So I don't know if the panel know, but there's a big campaign that's probably starting in America. It's called Go Fossil Free, and it is extremely inspirational. It's led by the 350 Degrees org. And they've already got 300 universities in the States involved in it, and 10 cities or states. So, for example, the mayor of Seattle has signed up to go fossil free. So that's coming to the UK in the autumn. People and Planet are bringing that. But also it is about each and every one of us taking action there. So if your pension fund is involved, then you might like to lobby about directly at that one. So if you could make any of those pledges that are on the sheet, we'd be very pleased. So if you could fill that in. So that's Sheffield Climate Alliance action. But it also keeps us in touch with you so we can, you know, gather again or talk about different things that you might like to kind of lead on. So, Suzanne, I'll give you a chance to advertise the evening on the 27th in a minute. Now, it's 9 o'clock. I want Jack to be able to make some closing remarks so we can have some definitive action that's come from today. Maybe one thing that I could ask for is, I mean, obviously there are a lot of people who are interested and have a lot of knowledge, and working out how to make the best use of that, I think, would be a good step forward. Because although you want us to support good things that you do, if we don't know what you're going to do beforehand, we can't support it. So we need a better system of kind of community engagement, if you like, I would say. I think, Andy, there are parts of the university that we haven't tapped. For example, there's a media department. There's a professor of journalism or something. I think he's next door to the Institute of Public Health or Shah or something. So there are psychologists, there are, you know, we have, you know, taking your point about
you know, the land, you've gone down quite a technical route, but there are other people who we could engage who could help. Okay, so I'm looking for actions now, and I'll pass the microphone to Jack, and then maybe if people want to stand up and say if there are actions they want to take, rather than questions.
Thank you, Jane. Well, look, I'm not going to pretend I'm going to leave here with a whole long list of actions. There's some very specific things I need to do, and clearly there's some other questions that were put that we as a panel didn't get a chance to answer. Something about the cycle issue in particular, something about air quality as well. So we will make sure that we write to the Climate Alliance. You can put answers to those questions on the website, so those at least will be answered properly. And I'll answer the points made by the gentleman who left as well. Absolutely no problem whatsoever. In terms of other action, though, we will be bringing forward the terms of reference for our Green Commission very shortly. That is the vehicle that we're going to use for the next 2 years in Sheffield to tackle climate change. So that is the engine that will push us up as a city forward. Okay, and I just want to be really clear about that. I want to set high expectations that we meet about that. Okay, there's no Birmingham has launched a Green Commission, and ours will be similar, I suspect, to theirs. But actually, you know, I'm really, really clear that you know, the expectation from you and the expectation from people will be, if we say this is a crisis and we need to talk about it in the terms of an emergency, we need to follow that up with action. And the first way we do that is to establish what we need to do, because actually one of the issues we have in the room, and we've seen some of the examples tonight, is you will get people who agree entirely on climate change and carbon emissions as an issue, and disagree massively on what the solution is. You know, and that is one of the natures of the beast. So the most pro-nuclear people I've met have been environmentalists, and the most anti-nuclear people I've met have been environmentalists. And we as a council have got to form a view and take action. So I'm sorry that it takes longer. As the world's most impatient person, I wish it didn't take quite as long to get answers to some of these. So the commitment in terms of actions, I would love to have another session like this. I'm happy to hang around now for as long as any of you want, either here or if we decant elsewhere, that's no problem at all, and to have a more intimate discussion if people would like that too. So I am, you know, I'm absolutely available. I think my mobile number is available publicly anyway, as is my email address. You know, we can only go as fast as our city will allow us to go. So one of the things I hope everyone else can do in terms of action is tell maybe five people, which we've all got five friends, and tell five people about the scale of the climate challenge and the carbon challenge that we face, about this event tonight, and about the Green Commission that we're going to have in Sheffield. And I think if we do that, if we start a movement, there's been a lot of talk about organising, there's been a lot of talk about raising the level of public engagement, and I think it's something that all of us can do as part of that as well. So beyond that, the specific actions will be coming through in the Green Commission. I'm happy to keep talking for as long as anyone would like, unsurprisingly. But just to say, you know, this has got to be the start of the conversation. I'm really clear about the scale of the challenge we have, because every day that goes past makes that curve that we've got to get down in terms of carbon emissions even steeper. And thanks again, everyone, for coming off. I've had a great time, and I look forward to working with you in the future. Thanks.
Before I run breaks away, can you particularly give us some information on the Green Deal and the collective applications, if you like, on the Green Deal? People that might want to work with their neighbours in the road.
Yeah, well, why don't we do something at the end? Well, I'll hang out at the front here, so if anyone wants to talk about the Green Deal or anything in particular, we'll have a conversation at the end when the bulk of people have left, if they don't want to listen to that.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I just want to talk about a very specific action, the
and Jack, that we seriously develop this as a little project, basically. And that the main idea is that we use the resources in this city, particularly the intellectual resources, the technical skills, the know-how, for the two universities to put that resource into the city and into developing people's relationship with how they understand the issues. So it's everything that's been talked about in terms of jobs, health, engaging people, developing community networks, developing our power, basically, on resource sort of level. So we'd like to know from Andy and Jack whether you would seriously engage with the two universities.
Okay, we're going to talk to, if you come up afterwards, because is this an action?
I'm going to give you a pledge.
Yeah.
If you will consider making Sheffield a crack food zone, I'm just going to stick my neck out here, I pledge to help and work with you and to give you some of the resources that I have in my team, I have at the new team of parents here, to help you advise some of the parents and that stuff.
The action I'd like to see the Sheffield City Council and the Sheffield First City all is integrated transport. I've been here since 1991, came up from London, and yes, I am now acculturated to questioning the South. But they have a much cleaner and better transport system than it's integrated. And all the time we've been here, it has not been possible for the politicians and the various people who come into power to have integrated transport in this city. And that's what's keeping the air quality as it is right now, a lack of an integrated transport. And what can you do? That's the action I want to see the city council do, labor or whatever. And the Sheffield First and the unions, integrated transport.
Okay, thank you.
I just wanted to request that you send your presentations out, because I think those pictorial graphs especially are really good for convincing people of what's happening.
So if you could send them to Chris, Chris is going to put them up on Indonesia so that you can then download them or transfer them on the link. So, if Andy, I think John already said yes, we've got to ask Professor Anderson, but I'm sure he's yes. I'd be very surprised if he said no. Because we've got the sound, but obviously the presentations. So they go up on Indymedia and then we can, well, particularly if we haven't got your email, if you're not on our list, then you need to fill this in, otherwise we can't contact you again. Even if you don't have to make a pledge, but we love to make pledges. But okay, maybe this is the right time to say the formal meeting is over. Jack has offered to carry on talking to anyone who wants to carry on talking to him. Some people have got to get trained, so if we can thank the